fitness, nutrition, sleep, longevity, performance, fat loss, and all the keys to a life of health, happiness, and success. I'm Jed Zimmer, your host, and welcome to The Health Project.
About and it's used by different people in different ways, in different settings and different capacities. But it for me, being a high performer or embracing high performance qualities, skills, habits, attributes, behaviors is about personally trying to get the most out of what you have. Now, I would call my mum a high performer. And that's because she's 80 years old. She's nearly died three times with cancer. She's incredibly resilient. She's brave. She makes good decisions. She does good things. She asks good questions. And she gets the most out of her mind, her emotions, her body, her situation, her circumstance. So for me, high performance is about, it's not about who's winning a gold medal, who's curing cancer, who's flying to the moon, or who's making $1 billion. That can be a KPI of high performance if that's what fascinates you.
Right.
So I'm interested in all kinds of high performance, be it, you know, the guy that overcomes a heroin addiction or the 80-year-old, you know, mother that overcomes cancer three times and has, you know, life-threatening surgery on multiple occasions, or, you know, the guy who comes from a disadvantaged background that becomes a doctor of philosophy and a you know, an educator in the academic anything. It's just about high performance is not about only about sport, but often when we talk about it, we talk about it in a sporting sense or a corporate sense.
Yeah. And do you think this is something that most people are born with, or it is something we can sort of train and improve on over time?
100% trainable. It's like unequivocally trainable. It depends. You know, there are a lot of people, including me, who weren't born gifted. Like, I'm not a genius. I don't have a 300 IQ. I can't run fast. I can't jump high. I can't sing. And not that I'm the bloody high watermark for success either, but, you know, it's all about what we do with what we've been given. And that's optional. Like, no matter what anyone tells you, it's still, even if you have, you know, like somebody, here's an example, somebody like Robin Williams, RIP, you know, one of the greatest performers, comedians, actors, entertainers in the world for decades, battled chronic depression his whole life. So in the middle of even something as debilitating as a really tough mental illness, here's a person doing just these. And yes, he had an inherent talent, but talent isn't enough. You still got to do all the work, take all the action, and create all the results. Because the talent that you have, the potential that you have, is just a key to the door. Then you've got to walk through the door and open up into all of those things that, or step into all of those processes and practices and behaviors that create the result you want.
And what are, let's just touch on that. What are some of these behaviors and habits? Again, I know it's going to differ for what hop.
So not giving up as one. I mean, so many people start things they never finish. Look at, you know, every January in Australia, millions of people start a weight loss, a fitness, a health campaign, a gym camp, whatever. We don't have really clear data on this, but I can give you a pretty good insight because I worked in that space for 3+ decades and owned gyms for 25 years. The vast majority of people who make a January 1 resolution, even the people who have the resources, the reasons, and the potential, very few of them create sustained change.
And what do you think that it is? And what is your advice? Is it to set more realistic goals?
My advice is don't rely on motivation.
Right.
It's a sometimes emotion. And so people talk about, you know, I've just lost motivation. And so I go, cool, keep doing it anyway. They're like, what? I go, well, if you don't feel motivated, still do it. You know, there's this unwritten kind of, I guess, rule that, well, if I'm not motivated now, I don't do it. Well, if that was the case, there are a lot of highly successful people in a broad range of fields who would never have succeeded because nobody is permanently in the zone and pumped and excited and inspired and motivated. Nobody's that. Everybody goes through peaks and troughs. So if you want to be successful, whatever success means for you, that is largely about your ability to do what most people won't do when it counts. It's about your ability to keep being proactive and productive and effective when you can't be bothered. And most of us can't be bothered a lot of the time.
I want to touch on resilience. I know resilience is something you're quite passionate about. When we are faced with adversity, it's something that, that each of us is going to face in sort of our life. How can we prepare ourselves, build resilience, I guess you could say, to overcome this adversity?
Okay, so I'm going to tell you, if in 6 months, I'm going to send you into the gym and I'm going to train with you, and we're going to train together. And let's say, I don't know how strong you are, aunt, but let's go right now. You know, I'm twice your strength and I'm going to train with you and you want to kind of keep up with me. What are you going to do for the next 6 months?
Put in extra work, do all the little things outside of the gym.
So you're going to prepare, right? So how do we get physically strong? By working against resistance, which is why it's called resistance training. Progressive overload. That's how we get physically strong. How do we get mentally and emotionally strong? By working against resistance, right? It's the same principle. Resistance training for your mind is analogous to resistance training for your body. So what that means is, okay, what am I scared of? I'm public speaking. Okay. Well, how do you get good at public speaking? Well, not by fucking avoiding it. You can't get good at what you don't do. You can't master the thing that you avoid, but people spend their life avoiding things that scare them, thereby putting themselves in a prison of weakness. So they build their own, self-limitation prison because they'll never do. Now, that doesn't mean we've got to do stupid things or overly risky, but it just means quite often the things that we need to do to improve, to learn, to grow, to adapt, to build resilience are definitely not the things we're comfortable with or want to do.
So would you say training the brain, just in simple terms, is very similar to the way that obviously we see with physical changes when people go on and train their body, the progressive overload and the growth adaptation is very similar?
100%. Working against resistance. I started a... where are we at now? I started a PhD 5.5 months ago. The first 3 months were mind-blowingly uncomfortable because I'm not an academic, really. You know, I'm figuring it out. I'm the dumbest one at Monash, and I'm definitely the dumbest one in my room. And you go, well, how do I get good at doing a PhD? Well, you don't get good at doing it by not going to uni or avoiding it. So I knew that I would be uncomfortable. I knew that it would be hard. I knew that I would be the least equipped at that point in time. And now, nearly 6 months down the track, my anxiety and my fear and my discomfort has subsided somewhat. And now I'm starting to understand, build strength, build insight, build awareness, build skill around this thing that I was a 1 out of 10 at.
I love it. Is it what are some other personal development rituals? Is there sort of, I'm going to say, is there rituals you've got in a day-to-day basis regarding personal development?
Look, I mean, there are, you know, like I talk for 2 days without notes. So that's like saying, give me 3 words from the Bible. But, you know, so for me, very much living authentically matters. If you follow my stuff, you probably know that. I'm real and raw. I talk about my faults and flaws, of which there are many. I talk about my fuck-ups, of which there have been thousands. I never portray myself as an expert because I'm not. But what I am is somebody who's got a lot of experience and insight and stories and, I guess, ideas that can help people. So for me, it's about, one, what are my values? So what are the things that matter most to me in life, not in business, not in relation, in everything? And two, is the way that I live, my lifestyle, my relationships, my choices, my behaviors, my words, is the way that I live a reflection of my values?
Yeah.
And if it's not, I'm full of shit.
Mm.
And if it's not, maybe they're really not my values. I just like saying it because they all sound really kind of, you know, generous and kind and amazing. So for me, I'm interested in authenticity. And yep. I'm much more impressed by a flawed person who's honest than someone with way more talent and charisma and personality that's full of shit. I'd rather work with the person with not much potential and not much skill who's just the real deal.
I love it. What's your advice, though, for people who are unsure what their passion and values are? I know for me, I've often said to people, the way I got taught is if you're going to go to a library and you've got to go, you have to hire a book, what section are you going to go to? For me, it's self-growth, fitness, health, these kind of things. But what I've found is a lot of people are genuinely not sure. Do you have any advice for the clients in this kind of boat?
Yeah, I think you need to lead with your heart, not your head. The stuff that, you know, because the problem is, or one of the challenges is from when you were born, when I was born, we were both programmed.
Mm.
And how old are you, Jed?
21.
You're a fucking, my socks are 21, son. So for 21 years, want it or not, like it or not, you've been programmed by everything that you've been exposed to.
Yeah.
So that would be the books that you read, the people that you hang out with, your educational experiences, your mum, your dad, whatever, church, media, social media. And now here you are, you're 21, and you've got a worldview, and it's not a right worldview or a wrong worldview. It's just your worldview.
Awesome. And so
the challenge is, how do I really find out what I think, not what I've been told or taught or trained to believe, what I think, not what have I read, not what did I hear, not what did someone kind of teach me, but what do I innately and authentically know that I have come to realize on my own?
Right.
Right? And because I was taught and told and trained that success was about what you have, what you earn, what you own, what you look like, what you drive, where you live, right? Yep. That's what I was taught, either consciously or not. And then I grew up, and by the time I was your age, I was managing gyms. By the time I was 25, I had my own gym. By the time I was 30, I was a millionaire. And in the middle of all of my success, and I was writing for the Herald Sun, and I was writing my first book, and I was doing all this cool shit. And in the middle of all of that, I was relatively unhappy. And I'm like, well, how can that be? I've got all this stuff. I've got a nice house. I've got a fancy car. I've got motorbikes. I've got all this shit. I'm ticking all success boxes. How come I don't feel successful? And that's because I was not paying attention to my internal sat nav. I was doing what people had told me I should do to be successful. And it's not that their advice is necessarily wrong, but a lot of it wasn't right for me. And that's the differentiation. Right. So I know that I can run businesses. I did it for years. I had 500 staff. But it's not my passion. What I'm passionate about is what I'm doing right now, which is sharing thoughts and ideas and stories and inspiring and encouraging and helping people get the most out of what they have.
I was going to touch on stress management. Would you say, from what I've just heard listening to you, I think this would be incredibly reflective of sort of stress. Obviously, if you're going to follow your values, a lot of the experts that I've sort of spoken to touch on things like meditation, gratitude. But just from obviously researching you, hearing you talk and all that, I think that this would play a huge role in the reduction of stress.
Yeah.
Is there any stress management tips that you like to put in place on a daily basis and are an
advocate? Okay. Have you heard of a concept called metacognition?
I have.
So metacognition essentially is thinking about thinking.
Right.
So let me tell you a story. So where are you sitting right now?
Sitting in my office. Just at home.
Are you home by yourself?
No, I'm not.
Okay, so let's pretend you're home by yourself, right? In my story. So you're home by yourself and you know that nobody's going to be home for the next 5 hours, right? Now, all of a sudden, in the next room, you hear someone and you know it's not your partner or girlfriend or mum or whoever lives with you. You know that it ain't them. And you hear somebody moving in the next room. So tell me what happens. So what thought might come to mind?
You instantly, you think someone's out. Obviously, you start to worry who it could be.
Yeah, and then you worry that who it could be. So you would be in what? So you would maybe think perhaps I'm in danger.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. Absolutely.
Okay. So all of a sudden there's a stimulus. Then the first thing that happens in your mind is a thought.
Yep.
Or a perception of what you think might be going on. That is a story. The story is there's someone in the next room, fucking hell, I'm about to get slaughtered with a machete, right? Yep. Or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's an emotional response very, very, very close after the story. Mm-hmm. And the emotional response, or at the same time, is anxiety, is fear. And then there's a physiological response, which is elevated heart rate, blood pressure, adrenaline, cortisol, norepinephrine, endocrine system, nervous system, all of these physiological responses because you think you're in danger.
Right.
You get up, you walk into the next room, you realize you've left the window open, it's just something banging against the window and you're safe and no one's there.
Mm.
Now, my question is, before you went and saw the window, were you genuinely stressed?
Probably.
What was your body telling you?
Oh, I would have been heart rate, as you said, heart rate would have been pumped through the roof.
Yeah, so you were stressed as fuck.
Yeah.
Now, you were stressed as fuck because you thought you were in. Now, that's just a thought. The reality, the external reality, no one's there, you're safe, you're fine.
Mm-hmm.
The internal reality, which is where you live, thought, emotion, the internal reality is fucking hell, this is terrifying, I could be in danger, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
So then what happens is there's a three-tiered response. There's a cognitive response, thought, idea, story, an emotional response, fear, anxiety. Then there's a physiological response, heart rate, respiration, muscular system, endocrine system, nervous system. All of that happens.
Yeah.
Now, all of a sudden, you find yourself in a state of total stress and anxiety.
Yeah.
So now I want to, but we know that you weren't in any danger. So you tell me, where does stress come from?
Our internal thoughts.
Yeah.
Our thought process.
Stress is about thinking.
Yeah.
Stress is not about the external environment. Stress is not about what's going on. Stress is about what we believe is going on.
Mm. So, which is why
some people right now, in the middle of a very, very similar situation to the person next door, that is, we're all experiencing lockdown and COVID and face masks and fucking social, all that stuff, which is cool.
Mm.
Some people are absolutely calm. Some people are actually enjoying it because it's just a really interesting new normal and they've got some time away from work. And then the person next door who's got the same stimuli, they are terrified.
Yeah.
Mm. So stress is largely about being able to manage your mind. That's the snapshot.
Right. And what are the strategies that you love to train your mind? Is it meditation? What are some things you enjoy?
Well, I think the process of metacognition is being conscious of where thought comes from and questioning that.
Mm.
So meditation is largely about getting out of thought.
Yeah. So is this just something that it just takes self-reflection?
Well, you know, you have a thought, and then rather than go, you're like, the thought is, oh, he doesn't like me. Oh, I'm a dickhead. I fucked up. Oh, shit.
Yeah.
And rather than just buying into that, because then you create an experience for yourself of anxiety and depression, rather than when that thought comes, you recognize the thought for what it is, which is just a thought, not a reality.
Mm-hmm.
So I do over 150 keynotes a year talking to audiences and corporates and a lot more than that when you add in all my mentoring groups and stuff. But I often feel like a fraud going up there because I'm still insecure. I've still got issues. But I might be 3 minutes before I'm going on and I'm talking to 1,000 people and the 14-year-old fat kid still feels like he probably shouldn't be there. Because someone's going to figure out how fucking stupid he is.
Mm.
So I just recognize that for what that is. It's not true, because if it was true, I wouldn't have done all the shit I've done for the last 30 years. Mm. But nonetheless, the feeling or the thought in my mind is there.
Right.
It's about being able to navigate and negotiate the mental and emotional hurdles that to a level will always be there. Right. So for example, courage is not about being fearless. Courage is about being fearful and doing what you have to do anyway.
Mm. Yep, I like it. Very powerful message. I want to shift gears just to finish off a little bit. I want to go to your background in sports science. Athletic performance, this is something I'm quite passionate about. I want to ask, firstly, nutrition. First of all, what your philosophy is. There's a lot of theory out there about ketogenic diets, paleo, low carb. For an athletic standpoint, where does this sit for you? Do you think carbohydrates are necessary? Do you think athletes can thrive in a ketogenic diet? And when would be suitable for different athletes?
Yeah, I'll talk to you about that, but I'm kind of going to duck and weave. So here's the thing. One, I'm not a nutritionist, so probably not qualified, but of course I've talked about nutrition for years with people. Do you know what? Do you listen to my podcast?
I do, yes.
Did you listen to the one with Dr. Cam McDonald?
How recently? I don't think I have.
Yeah, you got to listen to that. It'll blow your sock. Right. So here's what we know about, you know, let's just put it all, let's talk about food, exercise, lifestyle, sleep, hydration, supplements.
Love it.
They are all things that we do, in inverted commas, to our body, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So here's what I'm going to tell you. There is no best eating strategy.
Yeah.
There's a best eating strategy for you, but there's not a global best one.
Yeah.
So let's say, for example, in some altered reality, you and me are the same age. We've got very similar goals. And you and I eat the same diet. We eat the same food. We have the same energy intake, micros, macros, blah, 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 same amount of sleep. We're not going to get the same results.
Yeah.
There's zero chance. Mm. We might go, oh yeah, but that's a really good diet. No, the question is it a really good diet for me? Some people thrive on ketogenic diets, but then they don't.
Just with that, what's your advice? Is it as simple as experimenting in finding what works best for you?
100%. Your body is a biofeedback machine. Your body knows way more than anyone that's going to tell you anything. Mm-hmm. So I haven't eaten to any particular model for decades. So if I'm hungry, I eat. If I'm not hungry, I don't eat.
Right.
So 6 out of 7 days of the week at the moment, especially, I don't eat lunch.
Yeah.
I'll eat decent breakfast. I eat because I'm sitting a lot because of what's going on right now. I'll eat dinner. And in fact, when I isolated nearly 3 weeks ago, I was 89.5 kilos. Mm. And yesterday I was 85.6. So I've dropped give or take 4 kilos.
Mm.
I've got as much muscle because I'm training hard every day. I've just lost a shitload of fat because I've changed. I've literally just decreased my energy intake.
Right.
But you know, it's like I've got mates who can eat shit and they're lean and they've got low blood pressure and they've got great muscle and it's fucking annoying, but they can.
Mm.
Then I've got other mates who look at a donut and they get fat. Mm. You know, so or they look at anything, and I'm pretty much an endomorph myself. So. Yeah. I think for me, instinctive eating and paying attention, because not only do we all need different micros and macros and energy intake on a day, you know, for example, I might sit at my computer like I am now and spend most of the day here.
Yep.
So I might need today 1500 calories to break even, but tomorrow I might need 3000 calories to break even.
I want to touch on that. Obviously, when it does come to fat loss and muscle building, is it for you, is it as simple as calories in versus calories out, your energy expenditure throughout the day, or does the macronutrient content, does this matter a lot when it comes to the different goals?
Yeah, definitely, because there's calories and calories.
Mm.
You know, you can't put kerosene in a Ferrari or you know, diesel in a Ferrari. It's a fuel, but it's not the right fuel.
Yep.
So, you know, I can eat a chicken breast and some broccoli and some basmati rice and it might have 500 calories, or I could eat a Mars bar and a Kit Kat and get the same amount of calories, but I'm not getting the same amount of nutrition.
Mm.
So it's about the, it's also, you know, the endocrine system response, blood sugar response, insulin production, You know, there are a lot of variables. It's about the thermogenic effect of that particular food. You know, the protein has the highest thermogenic effect, then carbohydrate, then fat. So there's a greater energy cost absorbing and digesting protein than there is carbohydrate and fat.
Yeah.
So not all 100 calories of protein, when it's broken down, is actually way less than 100 calories of fat. So there's a lot of variables around this, and people always, in look, I started in 1982 doing this, and people always want a fucking answer. There is no answer. There's a million answers. And everybody for the last 35 years since I've been watching it, everybody goes, nah, we've figured it out now. Like everybody. There's always another genius, another guru, another book, another model. And probably for 60 years, people have been going, nah, we've figured it out now.
Yeah.
You know, and I know I've got friends that do paleo and absolutely thrive. Yeah. I've got other friends who do it and it's not even just mental. It just doesn't, they feel sick. They feel exhausted. They get constipated. They feel fucking atrocious. And it's because there's not one particular model that works for everybody's individual physiology.
Right. I want to ask about a popular sort of topic, I think, going around things like the use of sauna, red light therapy, cold thermogenesis. From an exercise and sports science standpoint, do you think there's much value in these protocols? I know cold thermogenesis, for instance, a lot of people love it from adipose, from white to brown fat, red light therapy, these kind of things, sauna for growth hormone. From a sports science standpoint, is there much value?
Yeah, look, there is. I actually did, you probably haven't heard, but the podcast I did last night, I spoke about this very thing. I spoke about exposure to cold and what it does to our energy expenditure and to our metabolism in general, and also, you know, that kind of thermogenic effect of exposure and, you know, what that does. And so there are certainly benefits in cold, but once again, some people respond. I respond well to it. My body fucking loves it.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean everybody should do it. It's like saunas and heat shock proteins. Some people respond well. It's like some people, the best time of day for them to train is in the first, you know, 3 hours after they get out of bed. For other people, that's the worst time.
Right.
Right. The mistake that we make is that we think that there's a best anything.
Hmm.
You know, and because what happens is someone does something and they go, no, I know this works. What they're really saying is, I know this works for me.
Hmm. When it comes to the heat shock proteins for the use of sauna and heat, for me, I do it post exercise. How would I know if this is working for me? Obviously, with diet and all that, you can see results. Whereas with the use of heat post exercise, how am I going to know if this is beneficial or not?
Yeah. So the what I would be doing with something like that, which is kind of harder to evaluate, is I would be doing a 28-day, for example, a 28-day trial on myself. I would keep all of the other variables the same, so I change nothing.
Yeah.
And then I would introduce that one variable, and then it really just has to be a subjective assessment.
Mm, right.
It's like, I know for me that you could almost ask me anything about how my body works, and I can tell you exactly what everything does because I've done all the experimenting on my body for 30 years. So I know, for example, that I wish I could have 5 hours sleep and feel like a gangster, but I can't, right? Because I just can't. I've got to have, it depends on what I've done through the day, but minimum of 7. I know that when, like last night, I went for a 5K walk in outside. I wear bare feet most of my life. I'm wearing bare feet right now. I went for a 5K walk. It was 10:30 at night.
Yeah.
It was 8 degrees. It was fucking cold. And I wore a singlet and shorts, and I just listened to podcasts in headphones. And I can tell when I get home that a 30-minute walk in bare feet on a really cold footpath, it does something to my metabolism, and it literally does something to my nervous system.
Right.
And I get home and I feel like I've just done a 90-minute run or something.
Mm.
So there was a an article done in the Journal of Cell Metabolism that talks about this, the health effects of shivering. And the endocrine changes in our body in response to cold are exploitable in obesity therapeutics development.
Yeah.
Being cold activates, you probably know this, brown fat, which burns calories rapidly to generate heat. So there's, you know, but what it means is, so for example, it means that that lady that goes for a walk at 6 a.m. in the morning in 10 degrees and she walks 5 k's in an hour, well, she's going to burn significantly more energy doing 5 k's in an hour in 10 degrees than she will at lunchtime in 20 degrees. The same activity at the same level, the same intensity, same speed, same amount of time, different physiological outcome because of the environment.
Right. With your use of cold thermogenesis, you've just touched on your obviously walking in cold environment. How do you put it into place outside of this? Is it hot, cold, contrast showers, or do you ice baths?
I don't do ice baths. I do cold showers sometimes. I do the last minute cold.
Yeah.
Like stone cold. You know, I'm just aware, like sometimes I will, you know, for example, when I'm a bit cold, like when I'm a bit hungry, my brain works best.
Yeah.
So working in a 25 degree room, for me anyway, is not optimal from a cognitive function perspective. So I like to study when, or work or write or whatever I'm doing, when I'm not shivering, but I'm cool.
Yeah. I'm the exact same. I love it. And I want to finish off from a training standpoint. There's cardio, weight training. I want to look at it from an athletic standpoint. For instance, footy is a very popular topic. And a question is often asked, when should I be running? Should I run in the morning and then weights at night? Should it be the other way around? Weights in the morning. How do you strike a middle balance? Because I've often wondered, can you get the best of both worlds? Or is there some sort of, are they going to counteract one another?
The answer is a little bit, but so the thing about Australian rules football, and I worked with St Kilda, I was a conditioning coach for St Kilda Footy Club, Port Melbourne Footy Club. So I've worked with, you know, lots of elite teams in quite a few sports, but the training for Australian rules is possibly one of the hardest sports to train for because you need so many physiological or fitness variables. You need muscular endurance, you need aerobic endurance, and you also need power and speed and strength. Now, training for power is the opposite of training for endurance, but you need all of it. You need agility, speed, reaction time, muscular endurance, aerobic endurance, you know, your spatial awareness. There are so many training variables for AFL, and also it goes for, you know, 4 30-minute quarters, give or take. They are running like maniacs up to 20 kilometers a game for 120 minutes while tackling, being hit, hitting, catching, running, marking, catching, running, kicking, handballing, etc. So it's a very diverse sport from a conditioning perspective. So there's no set answer to that. Some people, it doesn't matter. Like, it's going to depend. I personally, I do cardio earlier and I do strength later.
Does your body get tricked? Obviously, your body needs an adaptation to sort of grow, get stronger in that. Say if you are combining running, or even just looking from a CrossFit standpoint, I've often wondered if in the same session they are running and they're doing heavy lifting, is the body going to get tricked?
In what way?
As in, well, I know for if you're trying to build size and strength, which you might need for footy, you do everything for that, so you eat in a calorie surplus, lift heavy in that. But then if you're running as well, I've often wondered, does the body start going, well, shit, I don't know what I'm meant to be doing.
Yeah. Look, there's a couple of more important variables the key with, you know, because running and strength training and trying to build muscle are contrary. So what you need to do is do the right kind of cardio the right way. So guys who are running K's and K's and K's for footy training then they're definitely not going to build muscle significantly. They might build strength, but adding kilograms of muscle is very difficult unless you're a genetic freak or you're on the gear. I'm not suggesting anyone be on the gear, right? but that's a fact. But then also, let's say, for example, somebody does find the right balance between strength and cardio, into whatever that is, whatever that looks like. So let's say they do, you know, like what one of my favorite things to do, as boring as it is intervals on the bike, because it doesn't seem to waste upper body muscle.
Yeah.
Whereas running for the same amount of time and doing intervals does, because it's body weight.
Right.
But on top of the getting the mix of cardio and strength right is also food, is also sleep, is also recovery, is also supplements and hydration. So, you know, if you get everything perfect, but you're just not having enough calories, well, you're not growing. Doesn't matter what you do. If you're not having enough calories, it ain't happening. If you're underslept, then you're fucking up your testosterone and growth hormone production. It ain't working. If you don't have adequate recovery, it's the same.
Mm. You touched on supplements a little bit. Is there any supplements that you're a big advocate, whether it's nootropics, obviously mine, the mindset is something you're passionate about. Creatine seems to be quite a popular one for things like anxiety, but also muscle growth. What does it look like for you? Whey protein, BCA, there's a lot of supplements, but is there anything in particular that you think everyone should be taking?
No, there's nothing that I think everyone should be taking at all, but there are different things that work. And I'm not trying to be evasive, but it's just like you can't make global statements like everyone should take X, because it's just not true. Mm. You know, so I just use some protein powder from Max's, which is a whey protein.
Yeah.
I don't think everyone should do that. I'm sponsored, so I get fucking gallons of it. and it's good. I have almonds, oats, psyllium husk, almond milk, and Max's protein powder for breakfast.
Yeah.
Sometimes if I'm hungry or a tiny bit hungry through the day and I don't want to eat a meal, which is most days, then I'll have a protein shake with water. Mm. But again, that's just figuring out, you know, that's figuring out what works for you. I mean, some people get great results. My training partner uses creatine, loves it. I use it, does nothing for me.
All right, there you go.
Yeah. I'm intrigued.
I was just going to ask from a nootropic standpoint. This is something that I've never actually looked into, but obviously with your research and what you're currently studying at the moment, is there any nootropics that you've experimented with?
I've never used a recreational drug in my life. Never been drunk. Never been high. I've never had alcohol, and I've never used. I've never smoked dope. So for me, I'm risk adverse. Yeah. So, but I've tried a couple of things. I actually was a couple of years ago, I had to do, and I think I've spoken about this publicly, but I had to do an all day event where I had to speak all day. And I went and saw my doctor, and I was absolutely exhausted. And he prescribed me a thing called modafinil,
right,
which is an anti-narcolepsy drug.
Mm-hmm.
And it's what it does. It's also used by some people as a nootropic.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't even know what I did with the rest, but I used one. I was exhausted. I took this, I had to speak from 7:30 a.m. till 5:30. So what's that, 10 hours with a couple of breaks, but so 8 hours ish of speaking. And I used, one of those, it just did wonders. But again, I'm very, I'm not going to keep doing that. My brain works pretty well anyway. I drink caffeine every morning. That's a nootropic. Somebody gave me some nicotine gum.
Yeah.
Nicotine is a nootropic, believe it or not. Not cigarettes. Not the, which sounds funny coming from a lifelong non-smoker. has a short effect. But again, you know, these are, for the most part, I don't think we need them.
Yeah.
And also there's a lot of stuff flying around. I wouldn't recommend people do them in general, because I think that, you know, people can get addicted to shit quite easily. And a lot of the nootropics are stimulants.
Right.
I have an arrhythmia, so I can't go near anything. Like, yep. I can only have 2 coffees a day. That's my limit. If I have 3, I can feel my heart kind of flutter a bit.
Yeah.
So, you know, bottom line is, you know, do they work? I think they do. Is it worth the risk? Mm. Some of them do for some people. Is it worth the risk? I would say no.
Okay. Well, I won't take up any longer, Craig. As I said at the start, I really appreciate it, mate. You're a huge inspiration of mine. I follow the work you do very closely, and I'm pretty excited to have you a part of this book. So I'll keep you posted with it. But yeah, I really appreciate it, mate.
All right, mate. Good on you. Take care, buddy.
Peace, Craig. Bye, mate.